Media Focus with Paul Blanchard.
This week, the BBC taking on local media. Editors have criticised the BBC's new plans to radically expand its online regional coverage. Could this move put them out of business? Advertising laws for the internet. A confectionery company was recently found in breach of regulations for paying YouTube stars to create videos, but not letting viewers know that they were, in fact, advertisements. Do we need to update the rules? And how much violence should the news show? Fox News has been criticised for a video on its website showing the graphic execution of a Jordanian pilot. Where should the line be drawn? And as usual, we're joined by two of the media's best and brightest. Guy Parker is chief executive of the Advertising Standards Authority, and Neil Malarkey is an actor, writer, management trainer and founding member of the Comedy Store Players.
Media Focus.
So first up, the BBC thinks that commercial local news is in decline. In their new report, they say they will do more to provide local news that properly serves all parts of the UK. But local papers were quick to criticise the Beeb's plans, with the CEO of Johnston Press accusing the BBC of parking a tank on their lawn and suggesting instead that they should make its local content available to them for syndication. Neil, why do you think local newspapers are in trouble? And is the BBC helping or making things worse?
Oh, blimey. That's a tricky one. The thing I've noticed is that people may not read newspapers, but they do go online for these. So these newspapers, they're less papers, more news out. I suppose. So the landscape is changing. For example, I found a wonderful writer called Joseph Schumacher who writes short stories for the Liverpool Echo, former cabbie, and they're on their website and they might well be in the paper version. I think things are changing because people don't buy papers as much. I read a thing today about how much fewer people buy newspapers for the 2015 general election compared with 2010.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole landscape is changing. And I think about a decade ago, the sort of BBC was told not to have local broadband video services because the commercial sector would. And nobody seems to have done that particularly. Maybe London Live, I don't know. But it's hard to know exactly how to define these things, because also, should the BBC's licence fee be cut because fewer people under 25 are not watching television? Or is it deemed to be that they're watching it in a different way? Are they watching through broadband and so forth? So my answer is firmly on the fence. What I'd like to see is more collaboration, I think, between local news organisations and the BBC. I don't see one that isn't possible.
Pretty well what Ashley Highfield, the CEO of Johnston Press, was calling for, actually. He was saying, why don't you give us your local content for free, thereby putting a tick in the BBC duty to provide news at the local level, and we will distribute it via our, you know, super trusted 120-year-old local news brands.
Some of them are 300 years old, apparently.
Some of them are massively old. They've been around for a long time. They're many of them are still very respected in the local communities. But of course, because of the technological revolution, they are really struggling at the moment. The money that the local newspapers have always relied on, particularly classified spend, but also local display advertising, is all moving online. Not all of it, but, you know, big chunks of it are moving online. So they can't afford to pay the journalists and reporters that were previously the boots on the ground that did the local reporting. Some of the newspapers are closing down in paper version and are moving online, where there's a question mark about how much they're being read by people because of the kind of competition online. So here's one CEO of one of the big local and regional newspaper groups saying, you give us your local content, we will distribute it and we'll credit you with the stories. Presumably he would argue that the BBC will save on not having to have so much kind of infrastructure at the local level, so they'd make some savings there. Mm. And could just contribute on content. Whether the BBC sees it as being a good deal for them, I don't know, but it was really interesting reading the recent Future of News report that James Harding came out with. This is the guy that used to be editor of the Times and is now
head of news. So he was the author of this report?
He was the author of this report. I mean, he obviously got a lot of people at the BBC to help him. It's a 40-page report. And what really struck me when I read it was the scale of ambition of the BBC. I mean, the BBC's got this Royal Charter duty to deliver news at the local level. It's got a duty to deliver news at the national level, obviously. It's got a duty to deliver news at the international level. I mean, if there was news at the galactic level, the BBC would have a duty to deliver it. It's just this massive obligation. And James Harding really, very firmly and unequivocally in this report, he does repeat the mission of the BBC to deliver news at the local level. And he kind of puts his cards on the table and he says the market is failing here. It is failing.
Well,
whether the BBC is responsible for that, though, which is the question here, is BBC competition killing off local newspapers? I think the internet is killing off local newspapers. BBC competition on local news probably isn't helping, but I don't think you can pin the full blame on the BBC.
But Guy, what do you say to Neil's point that the BBC did give local commercial media a chance? They held off on having video content rich stuff on their website so that the commercial operators could step into the vacuum and offer that, and they've clearly failed to do that. They've not invested, and given the BBC's charter obligations, they have a duty to mop up, and if the commercial operators aren't doing their job, then the BBC has to step in. What would you say to that? Is that fair?
To be honest, I don't really know. I know that there's been a big push by the current government to try and make, well, particularly DCMS, the media ministry, to try and push for local TV, and London Live is one of the early examples of that. But I don't think people think it's working very well.
No, Neil,
and
we look
across the Atlantic to America, where local TV is pretty big.
Yeah, New York has, say, for example, 7 local TV channels, doesn't it? But
yeah,
we can't seem to make one work.
But the economies of scale are very different. You know, it works with the number of people you've got in America. You can make that sort of thing work, but the geography's different. We're a small country, quite a lot of people in the UK, but we're a small country. And I think there have always been quite a lot of critics who've said local TV is just not going to work.
There's local radio, which does work very well in the commercial and the BBC sector. I did some work with the BBC, and much of what they do, people's interaction in this country, is with local radio. So when people talk about the BBC, there's no such thing as the BBC. There's central, there's all sorts of things in London, but there's lots very, very local. So you might say there's something for the BBC to build on there. They're kind of there already. There's local radio in the commercial sector doing very well. There's the well-trusted brands, Look North and so forth, of the BBC flagship shows. So I can't see room. And I remember Jeremy Hunt speaking a few years ago about saying we're all going to have local TV, and it hasn't taken off.
It was his big dream, wasn't it?
Yeah, because there's just not the, as you say, the economies of scale. There doesn't. Do you really want to have that? I don't know. It's hard enough watching local TV news in America, isn't it?
Yeah, do you think
it's there's a bear loose in the car park or something, rather than... Something.
Well, I do want to know if there is a bear loose.
Well, that's
in the
true.
Car
yes, sorry.
I'm very excited.
SMS. There's a trolley loose in the car park. That would be their lead. Well, it's not the college radio. The college football team. That's often their lead item on the 11 o'clock news.
Do you think it's a medium thing, though, Neil? That we're just used to getting our local news via audio rather than via video, because no one's really. I mean, we can all be honest here. No one's watching London Live at all, are they? Do you?
I couldn't possibly comment. I don't know where it is. I couldn't find it on.
It's on Channel 8 on Freeview, apparently.
Okay, right. Well, I'll look out for that. Thank you.
And very heavily promoted in the evenings now.
It is, yes. I'm always confused because it's in that left-hand column. I think BBC One, that looks interesting. It turns out it's not BBC One, but maybe I should make more of an effort to watch London Live. I don't know. I do mourn the loss of bits of paper in my hand, but then that's because I'm very old. And I used to like local papers. So I lived in Birmingham my gap year, and my great aunt used to take the Western Mail in South Wales. These were important things in people's lives. So they did. That was a kind of national, or certainly regional, newspapers do have something to say. And there have been, they do scoop journalism. But the thing is, these days, as you say, I think, Guy, it's the internet that's perhaps taken it away. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, these papers, Johnson Press are there, and others are saying, well, actually, let's get on the internet. So that's possibly why they're worried about the BBC saying, actually, we can do it. And they're saying, BBC, your job is to be London and international and national rather than local.
Do you think then that the BBC have caused this problem in some way, or do you think that they're just mopping up the problem that the commercials have failed to deal with?
There was a really interesting quote in the Future of News report that's just been published. It said, economic issues facing the newspaper business are not of the BBC's making, nor will they be alleviated by the BBC standing aside. Now, I think I probably agree with the first part of that, but I'm not sure I agree with the second. I don't think that the travails of the local and regional press the blame can all be put at the feet of the BBC. But BBC competing at a local level is hardly helping matters. But then the BBC has got this Royal Charter duty to deliver news at the local level and to provide high quality news content. So obviously it's going to do that. It's coming up for a charter renewal in a couple of years. It's going to be trumpeting what a good job it's doing at that. But the report was quite fair in one place. It talked about, it didn't just stick it to the local newspaper. It did say that there was a market failure here, but it didn't just stick it to the local and regional press alone. It said the BBC can't claim to be better than any of the other parts of the media. It's as guilty as others of cutting the budget of its local services. And it gave Bradford and how it had closed down a BBC office in Bradford as the example. I mean, it's quite difficult to argue with the diagnosis in the Future of News, BBC Future of News report, that technological changes have caused this gap in coverage. The gap is getting wider. People still want local news. So, you know, we, the BBC, who've got this Royal Charter commitment to deliver local news, we're going to deliver local news. Why wouldn't they?
So, next up, confectionery manufacturer Mondelez was recently found in breach of advertising rules for sponsoring YouTube stars. The Advertising Standards Authority found that the company had not made it sufficiently clear that the vlogger films were in fact advertisements, and that the personal nature of the videos meant that viewers were more likely to be deceived. Guy, do you think your YouTube ruling was a pivotal moment, and what further changes would you like to see?
I think it was an important ruling. The advertising codes that we police say that ads everywhere have got to be legal, decent, honest and truthful. And that includes ads online. And that includes online ads by companies in the social media spaces that they're controlling. The ruling was an interesting one because vlogging has become massive in the last few years. And we've all heard about people like Zoella and Alfie Days have now published books. They've got millions of subscribers. They've got millions of regular viewers who watch their videos when they post them on a weekly or twice weekly basis. They've got a bigger audience than the national newspapers. And whatever you think of the content of the videos that they post, they're extremely popular, particularly with younger people. So it's not surprising that companies get in there and want to explore advertising deals with these vloggers, and that's what's happening at the moment. And there's nothing wrong with that per se, so long as it's clear when ads are ads. And the advertising rules that we police have got a very clear rule that says ads must be obviously identifiable as ads. The reason why this ruling was important is because it provided quite a lot more colour on what that means when it comes to vlogging. You had Mondelez were advertising Oreo biscuits. And there's this thing called the Oreo lick race challenge where you've got to lick the cream on the inside of the biscuit off as quickly as you can or something like that. And they done deals with five really popular UK vloggers who put together these videos, posted these videos that showed them doing the lick race challenge. Now, these were paid for and the control of the content was ostensibly in the hands of Mondelez, of the biscuit manufacturer. So therefore, it's an ad, and it's got to be labelled as an ad. Some of the vloggers sort of labelled it a bit. A couple of them said, thanks to Oreo for making this video possible. But they didn't do so at the outset before people are committed to actually watching it, and we think they should have done. You know, we don't think it's fair to present stuff like this as being just normal, vlogging content, entertainment, information, whatever it is, when actually it's essentially an ad.
Just before I bring Neil in, could I ask, though, it's interesting because some of these vloggers are quite young, aren't they, in terms of should they have known that they had this duty to say that? And Art Mondelez, as the person writing the cheque to them, shouldn't their legal team have let them know that in effect they were in potential breach of these rules, which in fact you subsequently found they were?
We did. I mean, in fairness to Mondelez, they did cover off this angle and they felt they had gone far enough. We didn't agree. We didn't think they'd gone far enough in disclosing that these vlogs were ads. But they had thought about it. The most successful vloggers have got agents, and it's the agents that are often doing the deals. And the agents know all about this sort of stuff. That doesn't mean that there aren't situations where they don't disclose when they should. I'm sure that does go on and we pick up on it from time to time. There are also vloggers that aren't savvy about the advertising rules and are sometimes put in positions where companies or intermediaries, PR agencies, etc., working for companies, put them under a lot of pressure not to disclose. We hear stories from vloggers. One of the interesting things about the reaction to our rulings when we published them was the number of vloggers that said, thank you for ruling on this. It provides clarity in an area where previously we didn't feel there was much clarity. We've now got something that we can go back to brands and say, if they're trying to persuade us to just, you know, tone down the bit that says this is an ad, because people don't really like seeing that in video blogs, they've now got some ammunition to go back and say, no, we've got to do this, because if we don't, we're going to get into trouble with the ASA. So the challenge for us is educating what is obviously a pretty infinite bunch of people. Any of us could start a vlog tomorrow if we chose to. There's no cost barriers to entry. It's getting the message out there that this is an important thing to do. The thing that makes me optimistic about the size of that challenge is the vast majority of these vloggers place a really high value on authenticity. They've got this relationship with their subscribers and their viewers. If they start taking the money and surreptitiously advertising brands and, you know, products and services in their video blogs, their viewers are going to go.
Mm. That's what I'm told, authenticity. You don't want to be selling out to the man if you're a vlogger. So what should they do? Should they put, this is paid for by X at the front?
Yes, they could do that. I mean, there are various different ways, and it will depend a little bit on the precise nature of the blog or video blog. Because, of course, the same thing applies to blogging. It's not just video blogging that this applies to. It applies to any online content. And we're seeing similar challenges with Twitter and celebrities who are being paid by brands to tweet positive comments about those brands, and they're being told what to say. Again, that is an ad.
Is that in your jurisdiction?
That's within our jurisdiction. Yeah. We banned ads by people like Wayne Rooney for not flagging up that the tweet was effectively a paid-for Nike ad. Again, it's almost always about labelling here. It's about being clear and upfront with people. It's not fair. It's not fair if you're consuming content that you think is one thing and it's another thing.
I mean, what do you think to these YouTube stars, as it were? Because this is where even I start to sound a bit old, really. Now, I mean, the youngsters are massively into this.
Yes.
I mean, I was chatting with Ben Cooper recently, who's controller of Radio 1, and he said that some of the bloggers individually have a bigger reach week to week than Radio 1. I mean, this is absolutely massive opportunity for these big brands to connect with young people.
Yeah, I'd never come across this. I did some paid-for content, and suddenly it was back to the old days. When I first did TV, you had a seven-person crew, and nowadays somebody turns up from a TV company, one person with microphone. But they went back to the old days. They had proper budgets for this. And I'd never heard the word YouTuber. He's a YouTuber. And this guy had 18 million, you know, regular hits or something like that, followers, millions of followers. And they said, yeah, that you go to Radio 1 and the DJ is walking out the back door, nobody noticing him. And at the front, there's a YouTuber who's doing a 5-minute appearance and they're all over them. I mean, that's what makes our previous conversation about local newspapers kind of irrelevant, because who knew this would be such a big thing, YouTube? I didn't even know that YouTube was under any jurisdiction whatsoever by the Advertising Standards Authority. And it must be very difficult now to say, what is an advert?
It is.
Because there's PR content. Yeah. There's, for example, in a newspaper, somebody chatting about something, and then it says, you know, I'm helping the air challenge, and it's semi-charitable, and it's not.
Well, that's a really interesting, blurry, interesting and blurry borderline. The borderline between heavily PR-influenced journalism and advertising. I mean, most of us know that most of the articles that are written by many health and beauty journalists are reviews of products that they've been sent for free. I mean, these journalists just get sent truckloads
and
of free.
And often they're just cutting and pasting the actual review in as
sometimes,
well.
And sometimes there's not a lot of journalism going on. And it's the same with reviewing computer games. The most popular vloggers and reviewers who built up an audience because people like their reviews and people like them, they get sent every game by every game company, and the games company want them to say positive things about it. Now, we say that's not enough to make it an ad.
No, I think the differentiator was Oreo or Mondelez actually paid.
Yeah, they actually paid and they controlled the content.
Yeah.
And, you know, PR people will always be sending free stuff to important, you know, opinion formers and influencers. That's not going to stop, and that doesn't make the content, even if not much journalism has gone out, it doesn't make it advertising. It might make it bad journalism, but it doesn't make it advertising. There's got to be this control of content by the advertiser and payment For it to be an ad. But we do see this challenge everywhere. We see it with publishers who are trying to make their business model, their online business models work. They're trying to make their online sites work. So there's this thing called native advertising. Now, native advertising are the links to other stories that you see at the bottom of the, you scroll down the page, you read the article online, you scroll down and you see, here's some more stories from around the web. That's very often the intro line. And there'll be 4, 5, 6 stories. There'll be an image and a really hooky line or sentence that really makes you want to click. And these are paid for. And they're paid for ads for the stories that they link to. And again, we said in a ruling last year, they've got to be flagged up as paid for because people don't realise that. People think that editorial control has been exercised by the online publisher and they've selected those stories. But in fact, there's a whole ecosystem that's providing
backlinks and all this kind of stuff. It's all incredible.
And it's constantly changing. It's in absolute turmoil at the moment.
Have you got enough people to keep an eye on this?
We could always do with more people, of course. But
or do you have bots?
No, we don't. We have about 100 people at the ASA, and about in 2011 we extended the advertising rules to cover all of this stuff online. And it's now 40% of what we do.
How does it work jurisdictionally? Because if Wayne Rooney wants to tweet something, then Twitter's based in America, arguably, and Nike are based, you know, wherever, Japan or LA, wherever their marketing office is hosted. By what right do you say that the ASA has the right to intervene, just because people in the UK can see it?
No, we tend to go on the basis of the country of origin of the company that's doing the advertising. But that's a real oversimplification, and it gets a lot more complicated and head-scratchy. With certain difficult examples, but essentially that's what we're looking to do, and the rationale for that is we can then get in touch with the company. They're based here, and if we need to, we can apply pressure on them to comply.
When you go to them, do they say, "Okay, it's a fair cop. We didn't realise," or they're really trying to push the boundaries, presumably because you've only got 100 people.
Yeah,
or they're saying, "Come on, he's sponsored by this company. Surely we can do that."
We get all sorts of reactions. We get all the reactions you'd expect. I mean, most companies, most of the time, are mostly trying to do the right thing. They don't want to say anything too outrageous because it's going to come back and bite them. Mm. They feel that they are guardians of their brands, and they know that brands and trust go hand in hand. And if they do anything too stupid, they're going to upset the apple cart. But also, most people that work in marketing, you know, that most people have got a conscience and are decent people. The problem comes when people have got the blinkers on. They are trying to hit really difficult to hit targets. They're looking at things only from their point of view. They're not taking a step outside and seeing how others might see things. And you do sometimes get, of course, you get companies that are just, you know, trying it on and they're just trying to fleece people. And they're some of the biggest challenges from an enforcement point of view.
Neil, it's difficult to work out sometimes what's advertising and not. And I was just thinking of you, because you were in the Austin Powers films, weren't you, for your sins? And
I can admit to that, yes.
You were. And, you know, you watch Graham Norton or you watch Parkinson or whatever, and there's always a Hollywood star on that week promoting a film or a writer of a book. But you would never have the chief executive of Nestle on talking about a new, you know, brand of coffee. So why are some things allowed to be kind of... you know, on the shows and promote their products? It is indirect in advertising, isn't it?
And also in those films that are shown on television, you have product placement.
Yeah.
That's presumably been approved by, I don't know, actually.
It's Ofcom. Well, I mean, Ofcom is responsible for regulating product placement.
You weren't holding any products, were you, in the Austin Powers films?
I was, but I don't believe it's commercially available. All I can say, I don't know if guys knows to what you're referring. But yeah, why? Cause that kind of annoys me sometimes when it's a news programme and it's just promoting a film because there's a red carpet and somebody in a nice frock and a nice dinner jacket, and that's news. Or I like sports, so when people say, "Oh, why have we got the sports on the telly?" Are they promoting a brand which is a sports brand? I don't know. Where is there a line?
This almost could be philosophical, but where do you actually draw the line? What is to differentiate, you know, a Hollywood A-list, Tom Cruise, for example, going on Graham Norton to, you know, the Mondelez sponsoring a video blog? It's in effect, it's the same thing, isn't it?
Yeah. If you look at it through that lens, then it's all part of the same thing. It's all kind of marketing with a small M.
Because, I mean, the thing is, taking this fictional, or it's probably real example of Tom Cruise being on Graham Norton, they're never going to be asked anything other than tell us how great the film was. You know, the clips they're going to show are going to be provided by the movie studio. I mean, it's a hair's breadth away from being advertising, is it not?
Yes,
even though,
yes.
In a sense, Graham's editorial team does have that control. They could ask Tom Cruise anything they like, but
yes,
they probably won't, will they?
Of course, you're right. And if you think of it that way, most right-minded people would say it's advertising with a small A. You know, that's what it's all about. Whether it's the better question is whether it's any good, because if it's not any good, no one's going to watch it, and it's not going to be on for very long. It's not going to it's not going to be recommissioned, etc., etc., etc. So we sort of know that, don't we? I mean, we the viewer, when we watch Graham Norton or Jonathan Ross, and we see the Hollywood stars come on. I mean, they're not going on just because they fancied going on TV tonight. They have all got something to sell, and the hosts of these programs now tend to be very open about the fact that they've come on to sell something.
Well, the audience is complicit in it now, isn't it?
So we are sort of all complicit in it, and thankfully it's not for the ASA to have to regulate that sort of stuff. We've got plenty to do with online.
And finally, Fox News has been criticised for showing an unedited ISIS video on its website of the violent execution of a Jordanian pilot. Critics accuse the broadcaster of publishing the video to boost its audience at the expense of helping ISIS spread its propaganda. But Fox News has hit back, saying viewers weren't forced to watch the video but were simply given the option to watch, adding that their audience should be able to see what they called the barbarity of ISIS for themselves. Neil, do you think Fox News made the right call?
Well, this is the reason I don't run a TV station and I try and avoid difficult situations. I would not have shown it, but I don't run a TV station. I find anything like that really unpleasant. I did actually, by chance, when we were on tour with the Comedy Store Players, somebody showed me one of those video games, and I kept thinking, well, what are you doing here? You're just killing people. You're just, every time you meet something, and that's what video games are. So I'm very, very squeamish on anything like this. So I think that they shouldn't have. I can see that some people say there's something about telling it as it is and informing people, but I would think about the relatives of the person who was the victim, and I would think about the people who watch it and who may become bit by bit more and more accustomed to this as an acceptable way of being. And I would say, I think they made a mistake.
Do you think that there was a commerciality to their motives as well? Do you think that clearly there's an element of voyeurism, that some people did want to go to watch this simply because they want to watch this kind of thing?
Yes, and I presume they could have found it somewhere else other than Fox News. So Fox News just thought, well, we'll be the ones that put it into the mainstream, if you like. I don't think there are regulations in the States that we have, so it's probably, they thought it was a commercial decision. They might have said, well, actually, no, it was the right thing to do in terms of news values. But I'm pretty sure they would have got quite an increase in their viewership because of it.
I mean, Guy, it's very difficult for broadcasters, as Neil says. I mean, I remember the murder of Lee Rigby. The broadcasters found it very difficult to kind of, show what the level of what they should show. Certain elements of the screen were pixelated. I remember the execution of Saddam Hussein. They showed right up to the point where the trapdoor would open, but then they cut away from it and didn't show that. I mean, do you think this is a question of just degree, getting the nuance right, or do you think that this is a binary thing, that they either should show it or shouldn't at all?
That's a good question. I think it's a question of degree and nuance, and I'm glad I'm not the person that has to make these calls on a nightly basis, because they are really difficult calls to get right, because you're seeking that. I mean, this is all about editorial justification, isn't it? You're seeking to strike the right balance between a compelling and accurate and hopefully moving and informative piece of news, but avoid the danger, in this case, of being accused of aiding and abetting terrorist propaganda, or unnecessarily distressing people, or Neil's point, one of your points, desensitising people to these sorts of things. And in the UK, there's if the BBC, who we were talking about earlier, had shown this, then the BBC Trust would be all over them and would be asking them to justify on an editorial basis why they felt it worth embedding a 22-minute long video featuring the Jordanian pilot being burned to death. I mean, it's really difficult to justify. So I think, was Fox News right to show this execution video? I think from an ethical point of view, just absolutely not. I these decisions are often nuanced and matters of degree, but actually this one wasn't. This one's quite straightforward. A harder question to answer, I think, is what about showing a still image from the video, which Fox actually did on the evening broadcast? The embedded video was on their website. On the evening broadcast, they showed, for ages, they put up an image of the pilot on fire. So in the moment of death, similar still, but not the same, still images have been shown by UK news outlets. So the Mail showed an image. They showed quite a lot of still images from the video, but they didn't show him on fire. They showed the fire just creeping towards him, but they didn't show him on fire. So that's where they chose to draw the line. Maybe commercial stuff was behind it. Maybe political stuff was behind it. I mean, Fox News is quite a prominent critic of Obama, who they accuse of being soft on terrorism. Maybe that was a little bit behind it. But some of the comments that they've said have come across as a little bit naive about what the consequences might be of doing this. There was one extremism expert who reportedly said to The Guardian, and this is a quote, "Fox News are literally working for Al-Qaeda. Now, I mean, I wouldn't go that far, and it reminded me a little bit of the bit in The Princess Bride, where the baddie goes, "Inconceivable," and the goodie says, "I don't think that word means what you think it means." But the Fox News exec, who again reportedly said that he couldn't imagine the person who'd look at this video and come away admiring ISIS, I don't think he gets the way terrorist propaganda works, because
that's what
this
ISIS
propaganda
wanted.
This is what they want. They want this 22-minute video to be shown as widely as possible. They want
and Fox
it to spread,
gave them the platform.
They want it to spread fear, and they know that it's an effective recruitment.
But Guy, what do you say to Neil's other point there, that in defence of Fox News, they could argue that the video is going to be massively available elsewhere, and if they're going to be eyeballs watching this, they might as well watch it on the Fox News website, where indeed they did have critical voices as well on that same page.
I think it's a bit of a morally bankrupt argument. The kind of if we didn't show it, someone else would have. It's not a good argument.
No, I agree, and I think Neil, in your defence, you were playing devil's advocate.
You were. You weren't endorsing that argument. I heard you.
Yes, I find this just—it's
awful.
I've run out of things to say in it. In a way, it's just unthinkable, and I think Guy's put it rather beautifully.
Gentlemen, sorry about this, but we've run out of metaphorical tape, so we'll have to end proceedings there if we can. Neil, how do people follow you on Twitter? Do you have a blog? How do people get in touch with you?
Oh, that's very kind. At Neil Mullarkey. Now, shall I spell it? NEILMULLARKEY. I perform regularly with the Comedy Store Players, #Comedy Store Players.
And they're awesome. I do say that. They are absolutely fantastic. It's one of the best nights you could ever have.
Is this PR or advertising?
This is a genuine fan saying you guys are great.
I know, but have I given you... Well, I don't know.
You're on sacred ground. This is not subject to the advertising.
Why not? Why not?
It's not paid for. Is it?
How do you know?
It's not paid for. Not at all. But I do declare that Neil and I are friends. I think we can say that, can't we? And the Comedy Store Players is... what's the website for them?
ComedyStorePlayers.com. I mean... Sometimes when there's been some terrible incident in the world news, we're thinking, should we mention it? Should we not mention it? We tend to think, let's just ignore it. And somebody might say after a few minutes, and we ask for a suggestion, they might give a location mentioning this awful thing. But in general, people don't. There is a constituency that wants shock jokes, you know, and there's the old phrase in comedy, too soon. It's too soon, you know, because now people do jokes about Jack the Ripper, which at the time would have been tasteless.
Still too soon.
And also, well, you know, Mel Brooks and Hitler.
Yeah.
Unbelievably tasteless, but somehow do you vanquish the evil through comedy? I don't know. So it's a question that we face on a tiny basis ourselves, but we can't really make jokes about a country that's war-torn right now. There's no way to do it. There might be others who choose to do so, but we're not in that position, really, because we just do improvised silliness.
So, Guy, how do people follow you on Twitter, and what's your website address, etc., etc.?
So you can follow me on @GuyParker2.
Was there a Guy Parker 1 that beat you to it?
There was a Guy Parker 1. I was quite pleased to get on Guy Parker 2. I thought that was quite impressive.
Yeah, exactly.
Guy Parker 463. and if you want to find out about the ASA, then you can go to our website. Just Google it.
And for those that want to follow me, I'm on Twitter at Paul W.R. Blanchard, and you can go to our website mediafocus.org.uk and leave your email address and then get an email once a fortnight letting you know when the new podcast is out. But that's it for now. Thank you ever so much for listening. The associate producer was Jordan Greenway. I'm Paul Blanchard. Catch you next time.
A Big Things Media production.